You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where you want to make an enemy out of us because that means we'll talk about you more. Recently, ESPN First Take host Stephen A. Smith was called out by NBA superstar Kevin Durant. Apparently, Smith claimed to know what team Durant preferred to play for if he did enter free agency. But Durant replied by asserting that neither he nor any of his friends or family ever talked to Smith. So Smith was, quote, lying, making up stories. That a member of the media was accused of lying is not notable. Smith's response, however, is. Smith pointed out that he never claimed to talk to Durant's friends or family, only, quote, folks he knows in a league he has been covering for 19 years. Then he closed with, but I will say this lastly. You don't want to make an enemy out of me. And I'm looking right into the camera and I'm going to say it again. You do not want to make an enemy out of me. I'm not having it. I've done nothing wrong and I'm not going to tolerate it. I certainly understand why someone would be angry about being unjustly accused of wrongdoing and painted as a liar. I am a Tom Brady fan after all. If you remember though, Smith was the person who leaked that Brady destroyed his cell phone, a humongous piece of NFL spin in the Deflategate saga. I'd ask if Smith is aware of the irony of his comments, if he weren't just another example of how delusional members of the media have become. Smith is literally threatening to use his connections to stop Durant from practicing the craft of basketball. It's a cry that is somehow reminiscent of both James Taggart and Ellsworth Tui. Joining me this week, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. Daniel, are you going to try and tell me that you did well on DraftKings again this week? Because I lost all my money.
I am right now, I have placed in every single contest, if some of them just barely, but that likely won't hold because there's a game tonight. So,
is Monday night part of it? Because I was looking today and I saw that they actually have a Monday-Thursday contest as well where you only pick players from the four teams playing on Monday and Thursday night. And I said, how the hell do you win that?
It depends on which contest it is. I assume all the ones I'm in, I don't know about the Meninist one, but the other ones I'm in are definitely including Monday. But I'm number 99 in the Meninist one, but I don't know if that'll hold.
I think I'm like number 250. But I made a mistake. I listened to my brother. I had Rivers and Clay in. Rivers at quarterback and Clay at tight end. And he convinced me to put in Jordan Reed.
And then I played Clay at tight end in every single contest.
Yeah, see? Ah, I should have listened because Rivers and Clay did better than Reed and Rodgers. So I should have listened to myself.
That'll teach you. This isn't going to become a basketball podcast, though, is it? Because I like football, but all the other sports in the world are dumb.
Oh, no. I would not play fantasy anything else.
Okay. I just didn't want to. You talked about someone named Durant, and I didn't know what that meant.
Oh, well, as in regards to the opening, I think you understood the point of that wasn't about the basketball thing.
Yeah, I just don't want to. You know, some of our listeners are already afraid when we talk about throwing pigskin, and I didn't want to add to the fear that we might talk about other sports.
No. There's no need to talk about basketball anymore. The rules have been changed. It's not really a sport anymore. It's just, you know, big guys running at each other. Wait a second. Anyway, also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. Elliot, are you excited now that Halloween is apparently a 31-day-a-year holiday?
It's actually been a 31-plus-day holiday here in Orlando for a while because all the parks start doing their Halloween stuff like mid-September. So Halloween Horror Nights here at Universal Studios and the Not-So-Scary Halloween Party at Disney, and it starts mid-September so that they can rake in all that tourist money for the Halloween celebrations, and then it just goes straight on through October, and actually sometimes even after October, like November 1st or 2nd, it continues on.
That's true. I was looking at that because last year I did the Universal Halloween Horror Nights, Hollywood Halloween Horror Nights, because I think they had the extra H because we're out here in Hollywood. And, you know, it was cool because I did the front of the line pass, so I got to go in all the mazes and go on all the rides. But if you don't do the front of the line pass, you stand in line for like 3 hours for one maze, and the maze lasts like maybe 3 minutes. So it's really a question of me, do I want to spend $160 or do I want to spend $60 and stand in line for 3 hours to do one thing? It doesn't seem cost effective to me if you've been there before.
Well, if you live here, I don't know if in California you get the frequent fear pass, but we have them here and you can go on multiple nights. So, I mean, if you have that, then waiting in a line for something may not be such a big deal because you know you can always go back later on. So
I think that's a special Florida thing.
Maybe.
I've never heard of that.
Be listening. All you listeners coming to Orlando, that's a little tip for you.
From what I've been hearing from Daniel in the last podcast, that, or maybe it was off the podcast, even the Tower of Terror is better in Florida. So.
Way better. Florida is just generally better than California. I'm just going to put that out there.
Ooh, wow. Those are fighting words in today's day and age where people in California love to rip on Florida.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hate it because they ain't it.
Speaking of comparing things that are better and are worse or maybe the same as each other, it's time for The News with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad. Cause kid, there's consequences to what we say and what we do.
Videos made the internet rounds this week, both with similar setups but quite different subject matters. The first is one that drew my attention because it had the word Patriots and Tom Brady in it, and Justin's, I'm sure, too.
Brought a tear to my eye.
Too. I was holding it back a little. I was sort of fanning myself like a bigger black woman in a church. It was... So the video is adorable Patriots fan breaks down in tears when her mom surprises her with tickets. And in fact, she is an adorable Patriots fan who's looking in her backpack, something about Doritos, and then she pulls out a bag and it has a Tom Brady jersey and she goes, what is this? What mom? And then like when she realizes what it is, the little girl just crumbles into a heap of unbelievable gratitude, but in the form of tears. And then when she finds out there are tickets and they're going to the game that Sunday for her birthday, she just bawls and hugs her mom. It's adorable. Anyone who hasn't seen it should immediately go see it.
And a video like this gives me hope. And what I mean by that is the fact that this kid is aware enough to have that sort of an emotional reaction really shows me that kids are more aware than we like to believe they are. We live in this society nowadays, and they actually just did an episode of Last Man Standing about this, where it's we have to protect kids and keep them in this bubble and the world is big and scary and dangerous. But kids are a lot smarter than we give them credit for if given a rational environment. And I think this is an example of it. The fact that she is aware of how cool it is to get tickets. I mean, it's hard to get tickets to the game. They're pretty much all sold out. And have that kind of a powerful emotional reaction. She's integrating a lot of things there.
It's lovely. But as I said at the top of this, there are two videos. And of course, what would it be without a video that we think is slightly less compelling? But we'll let you be the judge of that. A trans teenager was caught on camera with her...
And by the way, teen means... 14. Teen means 14, yeah.
Yes. With her, for now, emotional reaction to receiving her first dose of hormones from her mother... Erica Mason is a mother of five from Detroit. She surprised her transgender daughter, Corey, who I think how this was, she was born a boy, right?
Correct.
I was a little confused by this.
Correct. If you look at the pictures, you can tell he was born a boy.
Surprised her transgender daughter, Corey, with her first dose of hormones, something the 14-year-old had been waiting over 2 years to receive. That would mean waiting since she was 12. And the video is similar in the sense that the mother says, reach behind the pillow, I got something, and the daughter sort of does this, oh, what'd you do this time? She fumbles open this package, smiles, and then when she realizes what it is, her face melts, and she gets up and immediately hugs her mom, and that's when the video cuts out. So, both captivated the internet this week for different reasons. What say you, gentlemen?
The interesting thing to me is, I think in today's day and age, people might actually say... the video of the girl getting the Patriots tickets is worse. because she's supporting cheaters, whereas the other one is actualizing her true self.
Actualizing her true self.
I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm saying that that's what they would say. Because I obviously don't agree that the Patriots are cheaters either.
Yeah, well, you know. It's a tricky issue, right? I think it's even more tricky when you're starting to talk about children. And 14 years old and going through this, wanting these hormones since 12, we don't let children of this age make a lot of decisions for the simple reason that their brains aren't fully developed.
Right, but that's the irony of what I was just saying, because I was just saying that kids know more and they're smarter than we give them credit for. So aren't we contradicting what I was saying here by saying that this kid isn't smart enough for this?
But is the kid lacking knowledge or just emotion?
Right, and there is a big difference between integrating a given value and saying that you have the knowledge of biology to make a claim that you should actually be of the opposite sex. Those are two radically different things.
So no, I agree, and that's my thing here is even adults don't know 100%. And what I mean by that is we've had large discussions on this podcast, long discussions about the whole Caitlyn Jenner thing, Bruce Jenner thing. But the conclusion that I personally came to is the science is unclear at this point. Adults still don't know if this whole gender dysphoria, body dysphoria thing, we don't have enough conclusive evidence about it. And now we're going to say kids, we're going to raise them from the time they're young and convince them that they should be an opposite gender? I mean, isn't it okay if a little boy just wants to wear a dress? Does that necessarily mean that they're supposed to be a girl? And furthermore, don't we have cases where parents raise their kids to believe a certain thing, and that's considered abuse because they've taught them delusional things, things that harm themselves? So I'm not saying necessarily this is harming the kid because we don't know, but my point is, where's the line and should we be celebrating this? Because if you read the comment section of this, everyone was acting like this was a good thing, and anyone who questioned it was shouted down as hateful and intolerant.
Yes, well, I am often hateful and intolerant, so I would understand why I was being shouted down. But it's really a thing here about an adult making a choice versus a child making a choice. I may think that Caitlyn Jenner didn't make the correct choice, if only because we just don't fully comprehend this thing yet, this science, and we don't fully comprehend the consequences of it. But allowing a child to make this choice, and in fact celebrating and encouraging it, is, in my opinion, child abuse. It is not tantamount to it. It is, in fact, child abuse. The end. But we live in such a screwed up culture where...
I'm glad you took that hardline stance. I was a little afraid of taking it. No bullshit.
She's 14! She was trying to get this drug when she was 12!
Well, that's what I was insinuating when I was saying there are some things we raise... where parents raise kids and it's considered to be abusive. How is this not abusive? That's what I was wondering.
14-year-olds have beer. That's, I think in this case, a little less substantively, maybe not the word harmful, but it's less effective on the person. Anyway. By the way, Corey, when he was 11, came across a video by YouTuber Jazz Jennings, who is transgender, and that's what led him down this path of wanting to be. So it started at 11.
That's another thing. It's only 3 years, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's just the fact that this came out the same week as that other video. And, you know, and honestly, it could have been any other team. You know, it doesn't have to be the Patriots. I mean, obviously, that was more emotional for me because it was the Patriots. But the fact that you have one where it's a video of a kid pursuing a value and celebrating a value, and another where a kid is dissatisfied with him or herself, whichever pronoun you want to use, and actively seeking to change him or herself on a fundamental level already. You know, I'm not talking about the kid's like, I'm fat, I want to be more active, Mom. I'm talking about he's trying to change himself on a biological, genetic level. He's dissatisfied with himself. That speaks to two opposite approaches to our culture there to me. One, celebrating and pursuing values. The other, dissatisfaction with your genetics and biology to the fact that you try to change it.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we take a meta question here for a moment? Which is, are we okay with parents filming emotional reactions to their children and putting them on the internet?
Yeah. You know, that was exactly the point I wanted to make. That was the point I wanted to make about this whole thing. Let's stop filming our damn kids and putting them on TV and putting them on the internet.
I mean, not just the kids, right? Like, I watched a whole video of somebody with a selfie video of himself during the Super Bowl, a Seahawks fan. Like, can't you just watch the fucking game? Why do you need to film yourself watching the goddamn game and putting it on YouTube? Are we going to hit a saturation point? And part of it is certainly what you guys are talking about, filming your children. But are we going to hit a saturation point where we don't need to film everything and take pictures of everything?
No.
I think saturation.
I mean, I know for Disney, like, we have the, like, there are ad commercials, you know, of kids filming, parents filming their kids' reaction when they tell them we're going to Disney World, which, I mean, in that context, I guess it's really, really cute. But I don't know, like, I'm seeing it all over the internet, and the worst ones are the practical jokes. Like that video about the parent telling the kids, you know, oh, we ate all your Halloween candy, and the kids like just break down in tears. That bothers me a lot. It's those jokes, the practical jokes and the humiliating stuff, like the punishment videos. You know, well, my kid cheated on a test, so I'm going to plaster her face all over the internet on this video so that the whole world knows that my daughter cheated on a test once. And it'll be, she'll forever be immortalized as a cheater.
I saw a particularly disturbing one the other day, and I, like you, Elliot, I think I do draw a distinction between a sort of joyous moment being filmed and a really destructive one being filmed. Certainly the latter is more harmful, but it was basically this boy who is, couldn't have been more than, he couldn't have been four. Maybe he was four. He was playing with a Fisher-Price plastic saw, like you would get on a Fisher-Price workbench or whatever. And he was sawing his dad's hand, and his dad had put in a fake hand and then pretended like the kid sawed his hand off and flung it across the room. And the kid was fucking mortified and like completely had no idea how to react. And the dad thought it was hysterical. And all the comments were like, hilarious reaction. It's like, you guarantee that kid is going to require therapy. Congratulations, you fucking monster.
Mm-hmm. And you get to pay
horrifying.
For it. There's the justice. The kid needs therapy and dad gets to pay for it.
Yeah. Alas, stop filming yourselves.
I think you mean Obama gets to pay for it.
Which you mean I get to pay for it and you get to pay for it.
That was
and
a
you
premise.
Get to pay for it.
You get to pay for it and you get to pay for it.
Everybody gets to pay for it.
Speaking of paying for it, no, not sex. This is not an article about prostitution.
Of the earth.
But this is the 25-year anniversary of a famous payout known as the bet during the time between Paul Ehrlich, a biologist and author of the best-selling book Population Bomb, and economist Julian Simon. This was the bet was made in 1980, and if you haven't heard about it, that's probably because our education system here sucks. But it was one of the most important sort of pop culture events of the time. Ehrlich pushed this notion that the Earth was basically not able to sustain the number of people here. And by the year 2000, he claimed millions of people would die of starvation. India would basically be non-existent. We'd run out of natural resources, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Julian Simon, an economist, said, "You're a fucking idiot. The human mind is the ultimate resource." In fact, his book is called The Ultimate Resource. And all the resources we have on the planet, we will find a way to keep them. We will never run out of a resource. So this whole bet thing they did was they made a bet that in a certain given period of time, commodities, the prices for commodities would either go down or up. Ehrlich said that they would go up because resources are finite. Simon said they would go down because if something is valuable, the human mind will find a way to get more of it and sell it. And so they chose 10 years and they chose, by a fake $2,000 worth of five metals, chromium, copper, nickel, tin, and tungsten. And then basically whoever won would have to pay the difference in that amount. So 10 years time, every single one of the commodities fell. From 3.5% fall in copper to a 72% fall in tin. Ehrlich wrote a check for $576.07, the difference, and mailed it to him and never spoke to Simon again.
Too bad he didn't take, like, oil for 30 years or 40 years.
Indeed. Indeed.
That's like picking the Patriots in the Super Bowl when they were 18-0. Sorry, dude. Sorry.
Whoops. But I think this is an interesting moment to reflect on this for a few reasons, not just because it was one of the most badass SmackDowns in the history of academic SmackDowns, but also because it says a lot about where we are as a culture that 25 years later, Ehrlich is the one who is still super well known, taken seriously, and is cited all the time as being this genius in terms of climate, population, resources, et cetera. And Julian Simon is basically completely unknown except to except to everyone who plays that stupid game of the lights. He did not invent that. Except to people who are hardcore in the energy industry or objectivists, basically. And well, I think it's real shame.
We see this throughout the media in general. I mean, not to go back to sports again, but sports especially, where they predict things and they continually predict things wrong and there are no consequences to them. These people in the media can just say whatever they want, and even if it's just proven wrong, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think the only two people I've ever seen punished for lying in the media are Dan Rather and Brian Williams. Can you think of anyone else?
Rachel Dolezal comes to mind.
But she wasn't a member of the media. I'm not talking about, like, random people. I'm talking about members of the media. We have certain protected classes. And, yes, they're leftists. That's my suppressed premise before Daniel blows up my suppressed premise again that I just try to get the audience to think towards. But there's a protected leftist class in this country that they can just say whatever they want, and usually they're in the media or academia, and there are no consequences to it. Especially when they're predicting the future. And this is an example of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing to note about Julian Simon and the concept of the human mind as the ultimate resource, we sort of take that objectivist, as a really sort of given, as an underlying premise, but it is a radically different idea than what is held in the mainstream culture today. First of all, a natural resource, a piece of coal or a container of oil is not a resource until we apply our mind to it and figure out how to use it. Just touching it or holding it, taking it out of the ground, does not mean it's a resource.
Energy, osmosis.
It is potential at best, but it is only potential because we've recognized it as such.
You mean we're not all Gambit?
No, although that would be problematic.
You were about to say interesting, and then you stopped mid-thought. I heard that.
Yes, as I saw my entire apartment blowing up around me. Yeah.
But what would you say they say the greatest resource is? Because I think they would say it's love.
It's got to be love or something like that, or the sun. Leftists really like the fucking sun.
No, I think it's love. Compassion, they would say. Love, compassion, you know, community, society, that kind of stuff. Socialization.
Yeah.
Because those are the two sides, right? You have the side that says the human mind is the resource. That's our method of survival. And the other side says we survive by working together.
Togetherness, collectivism as the ultimate resource. Oh, I can hear an Ayn Rand villain writing that book as I speak.
Stephen A. Smith.
So essentially what you're trying to say, Justin, is that the left thinks that the ultimate resource is the gun. See what I did there? Because I'm about to transition to a story about a gun.
Yeah, you're going to have to explain that one.
Well, because we have to work together. It's force. It's collectivism. It's...
Oh.
Government gun.
Government gun. Woo, bang, bang. Anyway, we're not talking about government guns. We're talking about actual guns. Wait, the government guns are actual guns. We're talking about guns that non-government people have that kill people. A story is making the rounds this week that was actually written in 2012... but because of the recent shooting in Oregon, has resurfaced. The article is on Slate by Will Oremus. Bizarre tangent.
Are you saying it's by Will Oremus? Like, we're not clear?
No.
Moose or squirrel.
Worst joke in the history of this podcast.
No. That was a good one. Because I think the thinking in this article is about the equivalent of a moose's thought process. What's going on?
Can I go on my bizarre tangent now, please? My bizarre tangent is that in college, in choir, we sang a song called Auré Moose. And it was a horrible song that had no words. It was basically just you sang vowels over and over again, and then you moved pitches, and eventually you did all these overlapping sounds. And it was obnoxious and horrible and made no sense, but really esoteric. People liked it. And I related only to this article because that's the only thing I could think of the entire time I was reading this article, was that fucking obnoxious sound the choir made when they sang Auré Moose.
Was there a follow-up to it called Auré Squirrel?
You're really going for, like, top five worst jokes ever perpetuated on our audience.
I like this one. I like it.
So the article is called, after a 1996 mass shooting, Australia enacted strict gun laws. It hasn't had a similar massacre since.
Okay, I need to say something.
Please do.
Correlation is not causation. I rest my case.
How dare you, sir? How dare you go against Mr. Auré Moose? So his point is that in 1996, 35 people were killed, 23 were wounded in Port Arthur, Tasmania. That's a real place. 12 days later, the Prime Minister, John Howard, who was a conservative, announced a bipartisan deal where basically state and local governments enact a gun buyback program. And they also prohibited private gun sales, required that all weapons be individually registered to their owners, and required that gun buyers present a, quote, genuine reason, quote, for needing each weapon at the time of the purchase. And self-defense was not a reason. In the wake of the tragedy, polls showed support for these measures upwards of 90%. So the question is, if America bans guns, will we no longer have any crime? What say you?
No.
Thank you. That's all I got, too. It's an absurd premise.
Well, I think, I mean, Elliot will appreciate what I'm about to say. They actually did an episode of Arrow about this, where they did a whole gun buyback in the Glades, which is the poor area, the poor violent area. And they portrayed it correctly, where the buying back of the guns only aided the person who was trying to take over the government and use it to violently force people to do things. Yeah. And I'm not saying that every gun buyback program is doing it, but I'm saying what they romanticized there was taking the guns off the street can only favor one group, and it's the group with the guns. That's what people don't seem to get. Like, they have this, I'm saying self-defense isn't a legitimate claim. And there, you know, there was this other video going around by the comedian Jim Jefferies, who I believe is actually also from Australia, and he's saying, there's only one reason that anyone would want a gun, because you like it. Just own it and say you like it. Do they not understand that it was legitimately written into the Constitution as an amendment because they understood that if you give the people with power all of the weapons, there's no way of getting them out of power if they become evil. It's fucking simple, basic logic.
Yeah. The Second Amendment defends the First Amendment. It protects. There is a First Amendment because there is a Second Amendment. It's because we understand that government is a gun. Government is force. We have sanctioned that certain measure of force to protect individual rights. But the reason why we have a Second Amendment is in case the government decides that it's not going to stay within that neat little box that we put it in and it wants to start taking over everything, like what's going on right now. There is a reason why people like Obama and his ilk in office, there's a reason why the far left wants to get rid of guns. And it has nothing to do with protecting the children. It has to do with disarming people that they know are going to be uppity. That's really what it comes down to.
Well, I think there's a little column A and a little column B. This is the old question of, are the people who are in charge of these parties and are the big name faces of politics, are they dupes or do they really believe these things? I think it's, as I said, a little column A and column B. But my question is, these people who legitimately believe that if you take guns off of the streets, there won't be murders, there won't be crimes, there won't be these mass attacks, you know, they won't just start building bombs. Because, you know, there weren't pipe bombs used during Columbine at all. No way, they didn't do that. Why do these people believe this? How have they been duped into believing this? What is their flawed premise, and how did they come to believe it so strongly?
It's an emotional kind of thing. It's just a guns are bad, okay? So ban guns, okay? Kind of thing. I mean, for the most part, Elliot's right that the smarter people who advocate these positions have absolutely no interest in actually lowering crimes. They have an interest in being able to use force unabated.
Oh, I agree. I was just pointing out that it's not all, it's not every one of them.
Yeah, and this is something that I don't like guns in particular. They're just not my thing. I shot some guns once, a handgun and an AR-15. Side note, the handgun was fucking obnoxious to shoot and a horrible thing, and the AR-15 was fucking awesome, and I completely understand why people would want an AR-15 to defend themselves at their home. Anyway, but people often talk about this as if it's some conspiracy theory that, oh, the government's going to come in and take over and cause us to do things we need our gun to protect from the government. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is purposely written into the Constitution, as Elliot said, for this specific reason. The founding fathers of this country were not conspiracy theorists. They were realists. I pulled up a quote here from the Federalist Number 51, which is a Federalist paper explaining why the Constitution was written the way it was. This is a quote about the Second Amendment. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control in the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. Mm-hmm. That is the entire reason for the Second Amendment right there. Auxiliary precautions against a tyrannical government. The end. Even if we had to deal with a mass murder like this every day, it would still not be worth it philosophically to give up our guns in case there is a tyrannical government. Period.
By the way, auxiliary precautions, great pretentious band name. But here's the truth that people don't want to recognize. Yes, these mass murders are bad, but do you know who committed the worst mass murders of all time?
I wonder if is it Walmart? Did Walmart do it?
Yes, Walmart.
Was it? Oh,
their lack of unions.
Was it ExxonMobil?
It was governments. It was big leaders of government.
What? No way.
No shit.
Yes. No, I'm sort of playing, but that is an incredibly important point. The people who committed the most murders in history are governments. Thus, we need to be protected from them.
Governments, just governments. Governments where the power was in one person.
Dictators.
Governments, by the way, who had incredibly restrictive gun laws and basically disarmed their citizens, like in Nazi Germany and Maoist China and Pol Pot and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Stalinist Russia. It goes on and on and on. But there are a couple of things about this. One, the Australian thing, I'm tired of hearing about it. It's a fallacy, not only for the reason that Justin said, but also because it's just not true. This gun buyback program that everyone talks about, they leave out one important word, which is mandatory. The mandatory gun buyback program, meaning you had to sell your gun back to the government. First of all,
government would shoot you.
Or government would shoot you. Exactly. Ironically.
And we say that they're not going to literally shoot you, but think about it. If they send you to jail and then you try to run out of jail, how are they going to stop you?
Mm-hmm. They're going to fucking shoot you. They quite literally, in fact.
Or beat you with a club. Either way, they're still using physical force.
And what people are missing, is that the government, even if they don't do that, they legally can now because we have ceded that to them. We have given that, we have given up that means of defense if you participate in something like giving your guns back to the government. They now legally can shoot you and they can do it for any reason.
Yeah.
Because the government, they are force. And if you don't like it, they can kill you anyway.
So I'm going to shift the discussion a little bit here because I think we've covered this ground. So I just want to have one final question here to sort of sum up this whole gun control mass shootings issue. Is this another example of the media pushing an agenda by making it seem like these killings and mass shootings are more frequent? Or is there really a problem with this in this country now? And if guns aren't the problem, what is?
It's 100% a gender-driven thing. First of all, the deaths from mass shootings are, I mean, they're horrible. Don't get me wrong. What happened in Oregon is gut-wrenching. What happened in Virginia Tech was gut-wrenching. I remember that very vividly in college.
My brother was at Virginia Tech when that happened, by the way.
It's horrifying. And the psychological terror has to be factored in. But at the same time, so from 2009 to 2013, which are the most recent stats, 227 people died in America in quote-unquote mass shootings. There were 38 of them in that time period. Sounds like a lot. It is a lot. It's too many. But 4,600 people in that time period died of choking to death.
What were the years on that?
2009 to 2013.
And there were 38? And how many of them were put on the news?
Right.
No, I'm serious. That's a serious question.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know how many were put on.
Well, the point is, it's like five, right?
Yeah, it's not as many as you would expect. But, you know, on top of this, 1,000 people died of accidents involving donkeys.
So, ban asses.
And the other element of this is you hear
that's,
about.
That's what I needed an episode name. That's the episode name, the ban asses edition.
There you go. But our glorious leader also likes to talk about how this doesn't happen in other civilized nations, but this is just blatantly false, especially when you do one tiny thing, which is correct for population. We get compared to Switzerland, Israel, Belgium, Germany, United Kingdom, Canada, Norway, Finland,
or even Australia,
etc. But all of these places have a tiny population compared to the United States. When you correct for population, the number one place for fatalities due to shootings, mass shootings, 2009 to 2013, is Norway. Because they had one. But it's 77 people were killed.
Just to make the point more concrete, because we started with Australia, there are only 23 million people in Australia as of 2013.
Right, exactly. In Norway, where they only had one of these incidents, but 77 people were killed, that's 15.3 people per million in their country. In the United States, over the same time period, even with these 38 shootings, 227 dead, 0.72 people per million killed in mass shootings.
Now look, here's the thing that I don't want to come across with these statistics. We're not trivializing human life. We're not turning it into a statistic. It is awful and tragic that anyone's life ends this way. It's unjust, it's unfair, and it in an ideal world would not happen. But here's the problem. When you start talking about trying to get rid of this stuff, you're talking about socially engineering the population and socially engineering life. Because there's no other way to do it besides controlling people on a micro level. Why? Because think about it like an assembly line. No matter how good the machine is, no matter how high quality it is, you're always going to end up with a few defective items. And some of them are going to get shipped to the store. If you've ever bought an action figure that there was a misprint on the front of the box, or the one of the legs was shorter than the other, you know, sometimes it just happens, no matter how good the product is. We see these companies do recalls. Now imagine something as complex as human beings and the number of human beings that are born every year. You don't think that some of them are just going to be born wrong, or some of them are just going to, the way they're raised or what happens in their life, is just going to create some sort of a defect? No, I'm not. Again, people are going to say, oh, you're just talking shit about these people who are bad and you're being intolerant. I'm not being intolerant. We need to have better mechanisms to help these people when we identify them. Rather than trying to control everyone, we should put a better system in place to find these issues. That's the problem. We're blaming everyone. We're blaming a macro level. We're saying the issue is guns. The issue is our society. No, the issue is looking at people as individuals and saying, hey, can we help them the best way we can?
Did anyone blame the gun when Cecil the Lion was killed? I was trying to remember. No, they blamed the fucking dentist. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we love to do in this country. We love to blame certain things and blame people for other things. And I think Daniel is going to talk about one of these such ways that we blame them next here in The Hopeful Romantic with...
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their
wasn't focused on.
All right, Daniel, you watch Blood and Oil against my best recommendations, so why don't you give us a brief review of this show?
For anyone unfamiliar, Blood and Oil is the new, I think it's ABC, although I never pay attention to the networks anymore because I watch everything on Netflix or Hulu. New ABC drama about the oil boom in North Dakota and the wild west roughnecking that's going on there. And of course,
thanks to fracking, by the way. That's why Daniel watched this.
Yes. Thanks to hydraulic fracturing or fracking, which I have a keen interest in because I helped the work on the film Frack Nation, fracknation.com. And so I was interested. I thought I'd give it one episode, even though it's getting horrible reviews and it's being called, what did one reviewer say? If you thought Dallas was great, then don't watch this. So basically the plot is this, I don't remember character names. I wasn't invested enough. They were not compelling. A guy and a girl are gonna make a new life and get married in North Dakota by opening a laundromat. This is something that people are doing in North Dakota. They're opening small, stores or restaurants because they can make a jillion dollars because there's a ton of money up there. On the way there, the guy gets in an accident because he's not looking at the road. Like, you're in the middle of nowhere. It's dumb. The setup is stupid. He gets an accident. They destroy all of the washing machines that they were going to install. And instead of owning up to it, he decides to go become a roughnecker because of some secret information that gets leaked to his fiance at a pharmacy. So they find out there's going to be a huge plot of oil that is going to be drilled, and there's only one access road. So they go to this guy who owns the access road, and they offer
really
him a bunch of money.
They keep this information under lock and key, huh? They're telling people at the pharmacy?
Yep. They're just speaking loudly at the pharmacy, and the girlfriend overhears. That's
so
how
apparently
she...
they don't have computers and social media and internet in North Dakota?
No. The entire plot of the show is driven by completely nonsensical situations that would never happen in reality. And I'm not even knocking on this as I want it to be more naturalistic. I want it to make fucking sense.
Right, that's the thing.
And it doesn't.
About romanticism. That doesn't mean don't have logic. It means have logic internal to your story.
Yes. If they had set up, all the computers are down in the world because of aliens, then it would have made more sense.
Or because somebody did some weird EMP and the show was just a ripoff of Lost. Yeah, it would have made sense.
Exactly. I mean, in a town that is entirely built on oil and drilling and contracts, the guy answers his phone and speaks openly and expositionally about this enormous plot of land with the one access road to it.
In a land, in a town, where... built entirely on oil, one man talks expositionally on his phone.
So this couple goes to buy the one access road from the old guy there.
This
who basically...
couple buys something from someone. I don't know, I'm bored.
Basically, they offered to buy the road. He's like, I need more money, but I'll give it to you at a discount because I hate the oil company. Because I hate them. So anyway... Don Johnson, who plays the oil baron, finds out. He tries to buy the land from the kid. They play hardball. Yada, yada, yada. Ends up with three guys fighting in an oil pit.
They weren't watching Chris Matthews.
Ends up fighting three guys fighting in an oil pit at the end that's about to be lit on fire, and that was the cliffhanger. The point of this show is that no one actually does anything on their own to get rich. It's all because of insider information. All the oil guys also get their inside information from government officials who give them the heads up. They don't actually know what they're doing. The couple gets the inside information because they steal it, basically. And they get the inside information from the guy who owns the land that he hates the oil company, even though they made him a better offer.
So nobody's moral in this show?
No one is moral because no one actually acted to do anything. So meaning they're also not immoral. Because there are no actions. It is all a series of strange consequences that result from horrible decisions by non-character actors, or
right,
non-participant actors.
Ironically, it's naturalistic, and it's the whole point of how the fracking industry is controlling these people's lives.
Yeah. It's fairly poorly done, stupidly written. I make a point in the show not to say, do not watch something, because I want people to make up their own minds, but seriously, do not watch this. It's awful. It's awful. It's hideous. It's anti-industrial. It's anti-fracking. It's anti-interesting. The end.
I like that.
All right, well, I just inserted the little sound effect there for good measure because we have the gimmick. We're going to use it.
I forgot about the gimmick.
That's okay. You were very angry, so it's fine. Let's move on. So something we talked about in our preview show was that Fox has a couple of new sitcoms. And they're, you know, they've been trying to break into sitcoms over the past 5, 10 years. I don't know. I'm old.
20 years.
Yeah, I don't know. It's been recently, but I don't know if it's been 5 or 10 years anymore because I don't know the passing of time anymore. It's weird. Like, I'll think something happened like a year ago and it happened like 5 years ago because as you get older, time goes quicker because you've lived more of it. But when you're young, it goes slower because you have less of a comparison.
Thank you, Mr. Einstein.
Yeah, no problem. So let's talk about these two comedies. The first was Grandfathered. It's starring John Stamos and it's about a guy who's the world's greatest bachelor, and he doesn't give roses to people, but he suddenly finds out that he's actually a grandfather. So who wants to go first here?
Happy to. If you like John Stamos, you'll kind of like this, because there's a lot of John Stamos. This for me was predictable. That was the thing I didn't like about it. It was very conventional. There wasn't a lot of clash. He finds out he's a grandfather. He tries to do the right thing. He kind of messes up, but not really. Like, cause he's still in his mess up, ends up being a good grandfather and everything's okay. Why am I watching this? What is the interest here?
There so what's was some your review?
Clever jokes. Otherwise my review is,
yeah, I think I'll just stay here a while. Enjoy the sunrise.
Daniel, what you say is interesting about it being conventional and predictable and about how he didn't really mess up. Because I had the same reaction because they went to the whole, you know, second act thing where he has to take care of the kid when his son is going on a date. And when he takes care of the kid, he puts the kid, his granddaughter, at his restaurant. And the kid just cries a little bit and then he accidentally plays a baby song over this fancy restaurant's speaker system, and well, who is it? Michael Irvin and Lil Wayne were kind of like, and the comedian, the insult comedian,
Don Rickles.
Don Rickles were like, "What's going on? This is weird." And I was like, "Well, this isn't really messing up," which made me say something to you. And I said to you, "I have never thought naturalistic comedy was possible. I thought by the definition of comedy, you couldn't have naturalistic comedy." But that's what this show was. It was naturalistic comedy. Or a doc comedy. A documentary comedy. I think we coined that term. I've never heard that before. So.
That's right. Bitches. Yeah. Urban Dictionary, that shit.
Yeah. Somebody get on that. I will say this. I will say two positive things about the show before I give my review. One, Padgett Brewster is incredibly underrated as a comedic actress. She's been hilarious ever since Andy Richter controls the universe. And she was the one thing I laughed about in this show.
She was the best part by far.
Yeah, she's just great. She can take any material and make it gold. And then the production value was very, very good. It wasn't like a traditional sitcom. The way it was shot was very good, and the set dressing and everything, just very well done from a production standpoint.
John Stamos still looked pretty hot.
Yeah, I was waiting for him to say "Have mercy." I really was. Like, I thought he wasn't going to say it in the way Uncle Jesse said it. I thought he was going to say something under his breath like "Have mercy." Or something like that. Like, obviously, I can't give a line reading because I can't act. But you get my point. So my review of this is... Yeah! Let's move on now to The Grinder. The Grinder is Fox's new sitcom about starring Rob Lowe and Fred Savage. And in it, Fred Savage is a small-town lawyer. And Rob Lowe is an actor who played a lawyer on TV for 8 seasons. His show ends and he comes home. And shenanigans ensue when the two interact.
That's
well,
it.
Color me skeptical. When I was checking this out, I thought it was the lamest premise I'd ever heard of for a show. I basically only watched it because Justin messaged me and said, please watch The Grinder. I need to know your opinion of The Grinder. And I said, fine, I'll watch The Grinder. And I sat there with a croissant.
I didn't mean sit in the kitchen and watch a sandwich.
Okay, that's 3 out of 5 worst jokes on the podcast.
I got one more. I didn't mean go into downtown and watch a guy make a monkey dance.
All right, that was better than the sandwich joke. But
I didn't mean go to a restaurant and get mad at the guy giving you pepper.
Thank you. I didn't mean go to Atlantic City and watch Michael the Grinder Mizrahi play poker all day.
I didn't mean to go hang out with Elliot while he's on his dating app.
I was waiting for that.
I didn't mean to go to an ancient bakery and watch them use a grinder to crush the flour for the bread. Are we done with grinding now?
Yeah, get on with it.
Okay, so I didn't mean
to go to the club and watch people grind on each other.
Oh, I'm fucking done with grinding. I have no idea what else you can grind.
Your teeth.
Oh, your teeth! Damn you, not having trained in acting. Okay, here's my thing. I sat there with a puss on and I watched it and slowly started to chuckle. And then started to outright laugh and then was completely bought in because I think the premise is now interesting once it's been fleshed out. The writing was outstanding. Not just good, outstanding. One of the better pilots I've ever seen for a comedy. Usually the pilots are fairly weak no matter what. This was an outstanding pilot. Hopefully it goes up from here and not down. But, and then who knew? Who knew about Fred Savage? Who knew he could act?
Anyone who's seen The Wonder Years?
I know. I didn't really like The Wonder Years, but not for Fred Savage reasons, just for things with narrator reasons. But he's comedic genius, Fred Savage. Was excellent. Rob Lowe was good. Sort of expected how he is, Rob Lowe. I'm in. I'm all in. I wanna keep watching. I think this might be one of the best new comedies out there. Certainly as good, if not better, than Fresh Off the Boat, which I'm still enjoying. But so I rate it a...
This is blasphemy! This is madness!
Madness.
This is Sparta!
I'm in the same boat as you, Daniel. The reason I wanted your review of it is I think it's right up your alley, where Fred Savage's character, even though he was a lawyer, had to bring note cards to court, and he had to read off of those note cards very quietly, and everyone pretty much didn't respect him. And then Rob Lowe's character came in, and even though he wasn't technically a lawyer, he was able to convince everyone using the theatrics he learned from having legalese written for him for 8 seasons. And the combination of those two won a case that Fred Savage would have settled on. So I think the show was advocating the value of rhetoric.
Because the grinder never settles. Yes, rhetoric. You pointed that out to me explicitly. I wasn't thinking along the lines of rhetoric when I was watching a Fox sitcom. Or not Fox. Is it Fox? Yeah, it's Fox. But it is a good point. So
I can't help it. That's how my mind works. I mean, I'm looking for the themes in the show. And I think that was a heavy theme in the show, is that there is value in this type of person and these type of shows. Because a lot of times we talk crap about these shows, right? Procedurals, and that's what The Grinder was for 8 seasons. It was a procedural. And we say there's no value, and then we say there's no value in actors. And we dump on actors a lot. But I think this show, even though it's ironically on Fox, it's usually more of a leftist position to defend people like actors. But I think this show was defending the actor point of view and showing the value they can bring. And having confidence in yourself and your appearance and carrying yourself that way and how that comes across rhetorically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would rate this a...
This is blasphemy! This is madness!
Madness.
This is Sparta!
Alright, let's move on to a couple of things real quick. Here's the thing that Elliot's going to want to give a review on, and Daniel won't because Daniel hasn't seen it. Elliot, share your thoughts real quick on the first 3 episodes of Doctor Who. As we go forward here, we will review each episode each week, but we weren't recording on a schedule where we could do the first three individually, so let's just do them all right now.
Okay, the season premiere was known as The Magician's Assistant, and we saw the return of Clara, Missy, a.k.a. the Master, and the Doctor, and the story revolved around the Doctor's, what he felt was his greatest shame. And we meet Davros, the creator of the Daleks, in that episode when he was a little boy. And when the Doctor recognizes him, he just kind of leaves him. And jumps to the future years later, where he encounters Davros near the end of his life. And he Davros remembers the past, remembers him. And, well, let me just say this, because I don't want to give a step-by-step account of the whole episode. But I generally have an issue when they try to create moral equivalences between the Doctor and the Daleks. And that happened more under Russell T. Davies than it does under Moffat. I don't think Moffat ever really explicitly states that. Davies explicitly stated it. He tried to bring it up in several episodes. You know, is the Doctor really better than the Daleks because he hates the Daleks as much as the Daleks hate everyone? So because of their shared hatred, the fact that they both hate means that they are equivalent. And I've always hated that theme. So anytime there's a Dalek storyline, I kind of grit my teeth a little bit because I know that it's coming. There's always that dig that they...
No. You grind your teeth.
I grind my teeth. Yes. Same thing. Grit, grind, either way, I'm not happy. I'm not smiling.
That's called a callback.
So for me, I think the episodes themselves were a lot of fun. I love seeing Missy. I love seeing the interplay between Clara and Missy. Particularly creepy at the end of this, of the part two, The Witch is Familiar, where she, or Missy almost gets Clara killed and almost makes the Doctor do it. I mean, it's incredibly creepy. But I think the story was pretty solid. I thought it was a lot of fun, but I just can't shake that ick factor of trying to say that they're the same when they're not the same. You know, this idea, you know, that because they both have hatred, they're equivalent, morally equivalent to one another. And I just strongly disagree with it. And it makes any episode very unpalatable.
Well, I think one of the things with Moffat, who is, he brings up the comparison to have the Doctor ultimately realize why the comparison isn't true. So he's kind of hanging a lantern on that, the same way he hung a lantern on making the Doctor a woman by making Missy a woman. And what I mean by that is, if you look at this Doctor, and Daniel, you'll probably remember this. In his first season, Capaldi, one of the major themes was, am I a good man? Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this is part of that. It's continuing that, where we think the Doctor's going to die. He seems like he's going to die. Missy's convincing us he's going to die. He gives his confession disc or whatever, which supposedly he only gives right before he thinks he's going to die. And then he has to confront Davros, and Davros telling him he's equivalent to him. Because let's be serious. What does evil do? Evil tries to convince good that good is no different from evil, because that's the only way evil can win. So the Doctor has to confront that, and he ultimately has to decide that he's not and see the value in himself, because one of the things the Doctor does feel guilty about and struggle with is this idea that, do I have a right to go around and meddle in everyone's lives? Because even if you're doing that benevolently, you still have to wonder. You know, Star Trek had a Prime Directive for a reason. Now, my review of the episodes are, I think this season's going to be darker. That's the tone I've gotten from all three, so I'm not sure how I feel about that yet. But I thought the first episode was really good. The third episode was decent, but I didn't like the second episode at all. And here's why. When I sat down and I watched that first episode, I said, who directed this? Whoever's directing this should be doing feature films. I thought the directing of the episode one was brilliant. And I looked it up, and I don't remember her name, but the woman who directed that, somebody give her a major motion picture. Somebody give her own series. The directing was beautiful. The shots were well framed. They were interesting. She had visual tropes. It was just a masterpiece of directing. And then the second episode was all just Clara talking to the Master and the Doctor talking to Davros. Complete 180 from then. And then the third one was just sort of traditional Doctor Who. We kind of got away from that last season. This episode was sort of more like that. And then we'll see, obviously, what happens with the second part, the reveal of, you know, this, that two-parter. Although I will say this, I'm surprised deaf advocates aren't mad about that episode, because they had the deaf person in there for one reason, and it was a, you know, a plot mechanic reason, and it wasn't a naturalistic reason.
Yeah. I don't know, I mean, what do you think of, I think it's interesting that they've been playing up Clara becoming, like, taking on the characteristics of the Doctor. I mean, we saw a lot of that last season, of her kind of starting to act like him a little bit. And I think, particularly by episode 3, you really do see her taking on his mantle and becoming a little bit more like him, to the point where he calls her out on it and tells her, hey, there's only room for one of me. You have to be you and let me be me. You can't be me. So I wonder how that's a theme that I'm very interested to see play out. Because we know that she's leaving, the actress, Jenna Coleman, she's leaving after this year. So very interesting to see where, if that plays into her absence or not.
Yeah, they're definitely setting up her leaving. So we'll definitely see how that plays out in the long run and how she leaves and everything. But as she leaves, we're also gaining more Doctor Who, sort of relevant to her. I don't think she's going to be in it, but they're doing a Doctor Who spinoff. I believe it's going to be called Class. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's what it's called.
It's called Class, and it's basically, it's about the school she taught at, correct?
I believe it is, yeah.
And all the crazy things that happened there. So are you guys buying or selling this spinoff? Because I'm probably buying it, because I'll watch it, because I watched all of Torchwood.
Oh, you poor thing.
I like Torchwood.
I did not.
I'm selling, because I am absolutely only watching for Capaldi. So anything not involving him, I don't care.
Don't you like Sherlock, though?
I do like Sherlock, but what is the what's the connection here?
Moffitt is producing it.
Oh, I mean, I don't like it. Okay, maybe, maybe.
We'll see how involved Moffitt is.
Right. Like, is he producing it, or he's like the is he M. Night Shyamalan-ing it now? M. Night Shyamalan.
Right, or like Joss Whedon did with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. kind of deal, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's different in the BBC. I think that if you're the producer, you're the guy.
Yeah, because remember, they have more time because they have fewer episodes.
Yeah. And they film their things in blocks, too, so.
All right.
Well, we'll see.
Let's talk about another show. Let's move back to American television here, and this will be our last thing in the entertainment segment. We heard news about more Marvel TV series. This time they're doing a comedy series called Damage Control, which apparently is based upon a Marvel comic series, which I had no idea about, but it's basically about the humans that clean up after the superheroes. Are we buying or selling this?
I selling.
Is it by Marvel selling? We've become that cynical with Marvel.
Well, I am. I mean, let me put it this way. Katrina was the one who told me about this, and she sent it to me and said, this vindicates what you're saying. And I was like, well, what do you mean? By the way, she just sent me the two words damage control, and I was like, what the fuck is wrong? What did I do now? And she said, this vindicates you. And my first thought is, well, thank you, but what is it vindicating me for? And she said, it's naturalism. Why do we have to show, and this is my thoughts now, why do we have to show the people cleaning up after these people in the aftermath? You don't think about the aftermath and the superhero stuff because it's not part of the story.
Right.
It's not real. I mean, this was the fucking argument about the end of Man of Steel, right?
Yeah.
When people were focusing on the fact that, oh no, buildings were destroyed and people were in them. That's not the point.
It's like people complaining about 24. I remember that.
Yeah, Jack Bauer has to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, Jack Bauer, how come they never show him in the bathroom? Do you want to see him in the bathroom?
I see that all the time on the zombie account. People complaining that nobody takes showers and bathes on The Walking Dead. And I reply to them, do you want to watch them bathe? And how would that serve the plot? And they get really mad at me.
Yep, because women shaving their arms is sexist.
Can you imagine watching Jack Bauer pee and watching people take baths and showers on The Walking Dead? Oh, wait, you can. It's called Orange is the New Black.
I wasn't done owing you. Burn.
Since we're all anti-Marvel then, I did a little research, and apparently DC is making a similar show, and it's called Powerless, and it's about the normal people who work at an insurance company when there's a world full of superheroes. Is that equally as bad?
Wait, really?
That's what I found. It's going to be on NBC, apparently. They already bought the pilot for it.
I think that's a bad sign for DC, but... I think at least it's one step better, though I'm not saying it's that much better. But the one step being that these will be people in a job that exists even independent of superheroes. It's just having to factor that in versus people who are cleaning up after superheroes' mess.
I mean, if Berlanti is involved, then I'll definitely give it a watch. I'd probably be buying it. But it just really depends, because I like the DC programming a lot more.
Well, right. There's a question, though, of which, if it's going to be part of the universe or not, because Gotham's not part of the Berlanti universe, the Arrowverse. And we don't know if Supergirl is going to be or not, so we don't know if this one's going to be or not either.
It's produced by Berlanti. I don't know if it's going to be part of their universe, because it's on another network, but it's from the same team. So maybe somewhere down the road you'll see it.
Right, but there's a difference between being produced by the same people and being in the same universe. Because when you're in the same universe, you're bound by certain rules. Whereas when you're not in the same universe, you aren't. So even though you have the same stylistic elements of a writer or producer or director, not being bound by the same rules can create a much different show.
Yeah, I'm still selling for now.
Yeah, I wasn't advocating for or against the show. I'm not sold on... the premise of, I don't give a shit about normal people when there are fucking superheroes. So. And I don't mean superheroes who are fucking, although I care even less if there are superheroes who are fucking.
Oh man.
Other things I generally don't care about. Whatever's on Reddit. So then let's go to it. It's time for Reddit on Reddit. Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way, EA blow, Steam rocks, got Res for my Firefox. These things are all on Reddit, mostly pics of felines, comma whoring felines. These things are all on Reddit, no we didn't post it, but we will repost it. TIL, first Reddit, and of course TIL stands for Today I Learned. TIL, early Toy Story scripts, were so bad that production was halted. Steve Jobs kept work going with personal funding until a better script was ready. When production greenlit for $17 million, Jobs demanded more funds from Disney, who refused until Pixar's co-founder was able to comprise a new budget.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys know this?
I think this is one of those myths that's kind of garnered some steam. I think in history. There are a lot of myths about Disney films and stuff like that that, you know, when you really actually check them, they don't carry that much water. So
I'm gonna go not myth here, though, Elliot, to push back a little. I know you're the Disney guy, but I am the Steve Jobs guy, so. No, I'm not the Steve Jobs guy. But I have read the biography and I've read other things, including
Have you seen the eight movies about him?
Ed Catmull. I've seen none of those, because most of them are terrible. All of them are terrible from what I hear, actually. But in the Jobs biography, they talk about the early script of Toy Story was much darker than this script. There's a judgment here about good, bad. It was just darker. Woody was more villainous than he ended up being in the movie. Not that he was horrible or bad or mean. He was just not sympathetic. And Jobs...
He was like a dictator, wasn't he?
Yeah. But he wasn't evil. He wasn't... He was just like a...
He was just
sort of like
a
central planner.
And the script wasn't necessarily bad. It's just not... It wasn't quite where it needed to be.
Hold on. None of us have read the script, so I don't think we can declare if the original script was good or bad.
I'm reporting back what's in the Steve Jobs biography.
Yes.
And... That was Jobs' evaluation was, he's just not sympathetic. Children aren't going to watch this and be interested. So he made them recut it, basically, and do rewriting until it was much better.
And so. a little note people don't really realize here. Do you know who did a draft of the Toy Story script?
Let's see. Not Zack Snyder.
No.
Not Brad Bird. Who's the Da Vinci's Demon guy?
No, it wasn't Goyer.
Oh, I'm out then.
Joss Whedon.
Oh.
I was saying Joss Whedon, and I was like, no, I doubt myself. Ah.
Oh, weird.
The line where, what is it, Woody says to Buzz, where he's like, you are a strange little man, or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
That when somebody asked Whedon, where can we see your influence on the script, he pointed to that line.
All right, then. Not the worst line ever. But, yeah, I mean, I think Jobs took everything he did very seriously and actually implemented a lot of things at Pixar that are still there today, which is, for instance, they show periodic screenings of a movie at Pixar where anyone from janitor to CEO is allowed to come and give commentary on the film. Basically, the idea being, you want as much input as possible. You may not use the input, but you want as much input as possible to know the possible directions you could go.
Wait, so are you telling me I need to get a job as a janitor at Pixar and then I can Goodwill Hunting a job at Pixar?
I believe the verb form is Goodwill Hunt a job at Pixar, but yes. Yeah, there you go.
All right, new life plan. Next, Reddit. Serious? What does proving your point to some random person online do for you? Serious replies only. Because I guess you really don't want to get trolled when you ask this question.
It's in the super serial thread. It says right above it, this thread is marked with the serious replies only tag. Replies that are jokes, puns, off topic, or otherwise no N contributory.
Wait a second, I had a thought. So, does it bring on extra meaning if you Goodwill Hunting or Goodwill Hunt Pixar and then you say, how do you like them apples?
Okay, officially 5 out of 5 of the worst jokes we've ever perpetuated in our audience.
Come on, that was a good one.
Can we move on to the horrible Reddit question?
Yeah, go to the question. What does proving your point to some random person online do for you?
Mostly nothing. It doesn't do anything for me. The only time I engage in arguments online, it has to be two or three really specific scenarios. One is I know the person and I am interested in helping them legitimately understand something, even if they're hostile. So in that case, I guess I'm trying to make them better. The second instance is if I think someone has said something egregious that I don't want friends of mine to think I either condone or don't have a rebuttal to, I will give one rebuttal, maybe two rebuttals, but then I'll basically just leave it just sort of as if you happen to stumble upon this, know that there's a counter argument. And the third is if I genuinely just want to make fun of someone. In that case, it's purely entertainment on my part.
I like that.
So, that's what it does for me.
I'm just not trying, man. I don't try to. First of all, it's not even if I were to prove a point, or if I had some, if I knew I was right in what I said, it doesn't mean anything on the internet anymore because I think culturally we are almost past the point, if we're not already, of persuasion. Like, nobody talks to persuade anybody anymore. So even if I were to be on Twitter and show every graph, every pie chart, every link, every study, you know, to prove the point that I'm making, the other person that I would be arguing with would have to, if they were intellectually honest, they would have to concede that I was right. And in this day and age, people won't do that. They'll just say I'm a racist or a misogynist or a self-hating gay, and that will shut down the argument. So I don't even try anymore. There's really no point.
Yeah, I mean, I think persuasion has moved into a much more personal sphere. And I mean, that's probably where it was always most possible. But it's really, I would say that historically speaking, we're at a time that is geared toward only being able to persuade people who, with whom you have an incredibly strong ethos. So at home, your friends, family, maybe family, people who are close and love you kind of people, but
yeah,
certainly not random idiot on the internet.
Yeah. I think convincing people on the internet has always been a Sisyphean task. And I think it's only gotten harder the older I've gotten because of what you guys are saying. And for me, I think it always was an issue of hope. If I can convince this one person, if I can get through to this one person, then I've proven my point of view is correct. And I've proven that people can be reached and people can be convinced and there's hope that I will be heard one day. And I think a lot of that came from, you know, psychological issues I've had, I have, I'm still dealing with. It comes from, you know, youthfulness and immaturity. But I do think it's gotten worse, ironically, that there's almost no conversation anymore. As you guys are saying, like, anything you post gets trolled by like 80 people immediately. It used to be such a small niche community, but social media and Steve Jobs' technology has opened up the internet for everyone to be a troll now and be unpersuadable.
Thanks, Jobs.
Yeah.
Jeez, why don't you just fucking die already?
Good God. Jobs. 6 out of 6?
I miss him. I miss Steve Jobs.
All right. Last Reddit. Reddit, what's the worst thing you've ever done to someone? Now, this is a tough one. Because for me, the first thing I thought when I read this was, I haven't really done anything bad to people. I mean, I've had disagreements with friends, as Daniel can attest to. But I wouldn't really consider that what this question's asking. You know, this question is like, have you murdered anyone type deal.
I'm not sure if it's quite murder, but yeah, I know it's not quite that, yeah.
I went extreme on purpose.
This week I allowed our audience to hear your horrible fucking jokes.
Really? Really? It's my podcast. This is on themidside.com. It's not on danieltrichards.com. Go there if you want to get bored. There you go. That's the worst thing I've ever done to someone.
Go there if you want to get bored and entertained by lessons of rhetoric. I still have a higher web traffic than you do.
Probably.
Yeah, I don't really do bad things to you. I mean, when I was younger, I used to lie a lot, but I never used to lie maliciously to hurt people. Maybe I gave someone bad information about me, but it didn't result in anything particularly terrible that I can think of. I've got something interesting. It's not horrifying, but there was a guy I went to high school with who we all sort of made fun of as particularly dumb. And we were a small class, like 80 people, so pretty much everyone referred to him as particularly dumb. But anyway, I wrote an entire series of short stories based on him with a character who is much, much smarter, who was based after me. And it was basically our adventures and me constantly saving him from killing himself of choking on his own tongue, things like that.
You wrote Rick and Morty.
Yes, essentially, but many, many, many years before and much less clever. I think it was called The Adventures of Simon and Bobo.
Yeah. Who were you, Simon or Bobo?
I was definitely Simon.
Well, Bobo sounds like a monkey, dude.
And he was constantly almost dying because of basic human tasks. So that's probably the worst thing, but it was sort of done in jest anyway. But,
yeah. Mine's similar.
How about you, Elliot? Give anyone AIDS?
Oh, wow.
Giving anyone's, no, the worst thing, gosh. Jeez. I carry a lot of regret around, back from my tree-hugging Wiccan hippie days. I carry a lot of guilt around because I've led a lot of people down the hippie-dippy trail, and many of them have not found their way out. So I still carry a little sense of guilt about my inspiring people to love dirt, so worship dirt and all that. So that's why I think I would argue that that's the worst thing I've done.
You're right. That's worse than AIDS.
Yeah. Worse than AIDS.
Yeah. Justin, did you come up with anything?
Yeah, it's a similar. It was done in jest in the same way that you did yours in jest. So when I was an undergrad, every year at the beginning of the year, everyone would walk, especially the freshmen, basically the freshmen, would all walk to one certain apartment complex. That complex was off campus the first couple years, which was why everyone would walk there. It was then bought by the school my junior year. So junior and senior year was on campus. But I figured out that the freshmen were going to do that. So I said to my friends, I have an idea. And I bought a Super Soaker on eBay.
And you filled it with cat pee.
No, just with water. That's why it's not too bad. Yeah. And my friends got water balloons. So we drove in a circle around campus past this group of people that was migrating this herd, and we squirted them with Super Soakers and threw water balloons at them.
All right. That's acceptable.
And then we went on the main highway and did it, too, to people who were college students who were walking on the side of the road. They were like, can we get a ride? And we threw water balloons at them and drove away.
Oh, God.
I still think it's funny. Does that make me a bad person?
It's water.
Yeah, that's
was
what
it cold?
Like, no, it wasn't cold.
Did you cause hypothermia?
No, it wasn't cold.
Did you go to school with a bunch of people who were related to the Wicked Witch of the West?
No, and see, that's the thing. I would imagine if that happened to me, I'd be mad for like half a second, and I'd be like, oh, it's water. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, I would be like, motherfucker. Why didn't I think of that? Brilliant.
That's why I did it, because I was like, why has no one done this before? Like, if we're going to haze the freshmen, like, at least do it in, like, a funny way.
Yeah, not make them rape goats and stuff.
Or charge them. What they would do is they would walk over to the apartment complex and then, like, make them buy cups for $5 to drink from.
Your school is lame.
Yeah, well, yeah. Anyway, we didn't do much learning in that school. So we had to learn in this podcast. What did we learn this week? How to do transitions, apparently. Elliot?
I learned that basically, hold on, I wrote it down. Because I love this idea so much.
Wow, you did prep work.
During the show?
Basically, Julian Simon is like the Patriots, and Paul Ehrlich is like, well, Peyton Manning.
Oh!
This is how bad I've gotten with these metaphors, that Elliot now understands how to do them correctly.
Excellent. I learned that some comedies can be naturalistic, and we should all write John Stamos hate mail for it. What did you learn, Justin?
I learned that I needed to apply for janitorial positions at Pixar.
Indeed. Clean up that guy's, what's his name? Lasseter. Clean up Lasseter's office. Get a job. Rule the world. Step three, profit. If you learned something this week, why don't you tell us on the Twitters, at The Midside, or on Facebook, /The Midside, or on Patreon.com/The Midside, where we have loyal supporters who are giving us money, real shekels, for the work that we produce here. You too can do that. You can give us 10 cents a show, $10 a show, $10 million a show. We will accept anything in between those numbers. And we really appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who's logged into Patreon. It really helps defray the costs, primarily for Justin. And if we got a loyal stream of these folks, maybe we could go more than once a week. Just saying. So, if you're interested in that, go to patreon.com/themidside. And most importantly, please tell your friends. Folks on the liberty.me stream, thanks for joining us. And please tell your friends, because they're probably all smoking pot and need to know. So, thanks.
I'm Justin M. Wisniewski, and I hope you learned something this week. this concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Elliot, I'm assuming you watched The Grindr?
No, I forgot it was on. This is a bad week, guys. I'm sorry. Work is just really, really bad.
Elliot's just waiting for the Doctor Who review.
And I sends me home, and I crash, and then I wake up, and I do it all over again. So I'm just so behind on all this stuff.